And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman Report. Doug Hagman, yeah, late on the scene, right? Doug Hagman here. I want to thank Joe for handling the first 2 hours of today. Great job, by the way. Great interview with Paul McGuire. Fantastic.
Well, he makes it easy, so.
Yeah, well. And, you know, the information that you had up front was really good. A couple of things. Just a couple of announcements. Number one, my daily show today was a best of, and I apologize for that. I'm not going to get into the reasons why, but I'll just tell you that it's a best of. So, but having said that, this weekend, God willing, I'm going to be doing, and I don't know when this is going to be out, but I'm going to be doing an exclusive BTR exclusive me. Talking about when people say the Owen brothers, okay, they have a tendency to minimize what happened and they limit the scope of the criminality with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Meeks, and others within the Congress. And I'm going to be digging deep into this, giving you the timelines, the people, the damages, the businesses, the product of our investigation, which has been parallel to others who've been hot on this trail. And of course, you know, we've had George Webb on talking about this and other people, but this to me is going to be, I believe will be one of the most thorough investigative summaries, you know, on the planet. And that's going to be coming up this weekend. I don't know what time. Just watch my Twitter feed. It's going to be on my personal Twitter feed. And that's the only place you're going to find it, or my personal Facebook. And you'll probably have an hour or two notice. That's it. If you want to hear it live. Again, I'm not sure if it's going to be Saturday, Sunday, evening, morning, night. Don't know when. Of course, just want to mention that. Second thing I want to mention, let me make this perfectly clear. In fact, I received an email on this, a number of emails on this. The Jihad Watch, Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch, has been identified as their headline is "Leftist Journalist Lauren Kirshner of ProPublica Threatens Jihad Watch."
Now, I saw that.
Yeah.
Jihad Watch. And there's several other sites that are going after.
Right. And I'm not going to get into who, but we're on this list as well. And I applaud Robert Spencer. The left is mounting an all-out assault against freedom of speech, and using Charlottesville to try to crush all dissent. I received this email today, writes Robert Spencer, and this was today that this came out. I also know that Lauren Kirshner had sent it to other counter-jihad sites as well. Well, it extends beyond just counter-jihad sites. It's all right, conservative websites. I'm not going to read the entire email or the entire exchange. I'm just going to read the bottom line of Robert Spencer's reply, the last paragraph. Because this is my reply as well. Nazis will be Nazis. Fascists will be fascists. Today they call themselves Antifa and the like. Excuse me. But they're acting just like Hitler's brown shirts did when they shouted down and assaulted anti-Nazi speakers. Now the violent thugs work in a more genteel fashion. They just pull the internet plug on those they hate. And hate, my words now, and hate is an understatement. Writes Mr. Spencer, you, Lauren Kirshner, are aiding and abetting a quintessentially fascist enterprise. Authoritarianism in service of any cause leads to a slave society despite the best intentions of who helped usher it in. Amen. And amen. Let me tell you something. I went on our back channel, back end of our YouTube channel today. and was greeted with multiple messages of your material is not suitable for all advertisers.
And real quick, let me just explain what's been going on with YouTube. They haven't so much as demonetized our videos and our accounts, but we have not been getting any actual advertising videos on our videos. So by default, we've been demonetized for almost a year now without them actually saying you're demonetized. We can go ahead and monetize the videos, but the advertisements don't show up in any of the videos.
Yes.
And we weren't making a revenue anyway. But they went ahead and changed that. And it's for, what, about 90%, 95% of the videos? And there's some weird ones
Pastor
that leave in there.
Pastor Langford.
Yeah.
Just Pastor Langford alone.
Yep.
His YouTube has been labeled as not suitable for advertisers. Now, the reason I mention this is because, and this is not about money at this point, this now is about absolute censorship of the truth. You see, those who hate, what is it that Dave Dobmeier says? Truth or hate speech
is truth, or truth is hate speech to those who hate the truth.
Right. Now think about that. Truth is hate speech to those who hate the truth. And that is Dave Dobmeier.
I don't know if you saw the CNN ran an article talking about the Antifa movement and stated and embraced their logo, peace through violence today.
Peace through violence.
Just like right out of 1984's War is Peace, ignorance is intelligence. You know, they have those slogans where opposites are true.
We are right now, we are in the midst of a cold civil war. And I just want to let everyone know that our position is clear on this. We will speak the truth, continue to speak the truth. We will not be silenced by these left-wing, deranged fascists, regardless if they call themselves anti-fascists. And that is our position. That's my position. That's Joe's position. That's Eric the Tech's position. That is across the board, John Roberts' position. And we thank you, every one of you who are watching this platform, listening to it. We've got listeners in 160, a whole bunch of countries.
And as I said at the beginning,
multiple, tens of millions of downloads. Yeah.
You can't get caught up in the news cycle and the sensationalizing of this crap, because if you go into, as I said, every town USA, any town USA, people are doing their jobs, they're going to work, they're going to school. Many people, the majority of people, are not paying attention to this other than, you know, a glance at the news in a doctor's waiting room or their local stations at the end of the day. The majority of people are going to continue to do what they have to do to survive, to provide for their families, to make money, and are not going to buy into any of this crap. And I think people lose sight of that when we get caught up in the news cycle, and especially we see how hectic
it is, exactly.
This last week.
But again, tune into, please, tune into my Facebook and my Twitter feed for announcements about this, because this is a proprietary investigative report. Inside investigators, our own investigators of the Northeast Intelligence Network. This is not, some of the material has not been published before. So, and it's going to be all in one place, and it's going to be your go-to, go-to resource for all of what's happening. The penetration of the, congressional committees and the congressmen on the Democratic side, unfortunately, or fortunately, it doesn't really matter. It's all one party anyway, but that's what that's about. Now, we have a very special guest with us, M. Michael Phelps. And, you know, I wrote a book called Stained by Blood. Stained by Blood was out last year. I guess it was March of last year. I think it came out. Was it last year or the year before? Yeah, I guess it was last year. And I thought I did a pretty good job on it. And, then I fell into the world of M. Michael Phelps, or M. William Phelps, I'm sorry. And, crime, murder, and serial killer expert. I'm going to tell you, he's the creator, producer, writer, and former host of Investigation Discovery series, Dark Minds. He's an acclaimed award-winning investigative journalist, New York Times best-selling author of 30, count them, 30 books. Man, I admire somebody who could write one, but 30? Wow. And they're all great books. He's a highly sought-after pundit. Phelps has made over 100 media-related television appearances. Early Show, Today Show, The View, Fox and Friends, True Discovery, Discovery Channel, Fox Channel, and I can go on and on and on. He's a member of the Multidisciplinary Collaborative on Sexual Crime and Violence, also known as the Atypical Homicide Research Group at Northeastern University, maintained by NU alumni, and I'm not sure I could pronounce that name, Enzo Yaksik. I guess that's the name. Now, he's got another book coming out, scheduled to come out in November, called Beautifully Cruel. One of his books, by the way, which I thought was an amazing book, was about the Happy Face Killer. It was his latest book, it was a book that came out. I think it was just a couple of months ago. I'm not even sure, but it was a fantastic book. And he's a crime writer, like I said, serial killer expert, New York Times bestselling investigative journalist. With that, I want to welcome M. William Phelps. Sir, welcome to the program. Can you hear me?
We're not getting any sound from you, Mr. Phelps.
Yeah, we're not.
We had some issues with Paul McGuire earlier, too.
Yeah, and
we'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We'll have Eric the Tech go. But I got
to
tell
Phelps, if you can hear me, we'll have Eric the Tech figure it out. And if we have to do it by landline,
yeah,
we will. But go ahead.
Yeah, you know, you might say, well, wait a minute, what does this have to do with anything that's going on today? You know, you talked to Russ Dizdar, and by the way, remind me to show you his message. I didn't do that yet, but you look at people like Russ Dizdar, and you look at the landscape of the criminal landscape out there, the landscape of crime, serial killers. I don't want to use the word fascinating, but it is that. It's more intense. And it needs the spotlight to be shown on it. And by the way, as we're doing this, I might as well let everyone know, because we're having a hard time bringing him on, we will skip to the bottom of the hour network break, so to make sure he's got the most time available. But nonetheless, Beautifully Cruel coming up, just some advanced praise. Phelps is the king of true crime. Linda Hirschkreet, her syndicate columnist, one of the most engaging crime journalists, by Dr. Catherine Ramsland. This is kind of my favorite. Phelps treads dangerous ground around like an Amazon jungle guide, fearless, compassionate, and insightful. And it's hard to strike that balance of being fearless and compassionate, but he does that. That is Jeff Fitzpatrick, executive producer of Dark Minds. And then Anything by Phelps is an eye-opening experience, that by Suspense magazine. And Beautifully Cruel is going to include 16 pages of dramatic photos. But I would urge everyone to go to the Amazon page, his Amazon page, or freshfiction.com. How's that? Freshfiction.com. And the links are in our program description. Okay, let's try this again. Mr. Phelps, thanks so much for your time. Can you hear us? All right. We're going to do this by phone.
We can't hear you, Mr. Phelps.
Yeah.
Don't know what the difficulties are. We apologize if they're on our end, but we'll get you up and running here.
Yeah. And we've got a lot to talk about.
You know, looking at his website, there's a book he has, Dangerous Ground, My Friendship with a Serial Killer.
Yeah, that's the Happy Face Killer I was referencing.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't say that title, did I?
I don't think you did.
No, I didn't.
But he's won a lot of awards, both for his writing, his nonfiction books, as well as the winner of the 2013 Excellence in Journalism Award.
Yeah.
He did, he's done a number of series on cable television. And folks, go to his website, mwilliamphelps.com. There you can find his books. He's got consulting services, TV projects that he's working on. He's got his Twitter feed at mwilliamphelps, and there you can find everything. He's even got videos, trailers for his book and whatnot that you can access there. Should be really interesting. I'm fascinated by the subject of serial killers and
I asked John, and I'm not sure exactly what the sequence of events was, but when I happened to be doing some research, Dangerous Minds. What was the
Dangerous Ground?
Dangerous Ground. I'm sorry, Dangerous Ground. I that book fascinated the heck out of me, and so then I asked John. I said, "Hey, do you think you could try to get Mr. Phelps on?" And so he went at it, and that's how this came to be. Because Dangerous Ground, the Happy Face Killer, is about Keith Hunter Jesperson. He was caught in March of 1995. He's in jail now for life. He's 62 years old right now, but he's responsible for killing at least 9 women. That number is a little bit iffy, in the early 1990s. And it was, it's incredible. All right, let's give this a third. The third try is always a charm.
I can hear him.
Yeah. Mr. Phelps, welcome to the Hagman Report, sir.
Hello.
Hey.
There we go.
There you are.
Yeah.
Sorry about the, whatever that was, but glad to have you aboard, sir. Mr. Phelps, let me ask you a question. I read your bio, noted your bio to the audience here. You probably get this question, and you're probably sick of it, but what started your involvement in your current profession of writing about true crime and serial killers?
So you guys can hear me now, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah. Sorry about that. That was a thing on my iPad. All right. So that question is answered in Dangerous Ground. I go into detail into that answer. But yeah, but the short answer for you guys, because you've been so patient with my technical difficulties. Thanks for having me, by the way.
Hey,
so we'll catch
no
up
worries.
There. Well, I mean, I started writing about music and, cause I was a musician. So I did the whole write what you know thing. And, you know, now when I teach seminars, writing seminars, I say throw that shite out because if we were to write what we know, we wouldn't be writing much because we, as human beings, we don't know much. So, I followed that, started writing about music and learned very quickly that there was not a career waiting for me writing about music. And so I kind of just stumbled onto a crime, some corruption and racism inside the NYPD that a guy was reporting, and I started writing about that, and that kind of led me into the crime genre.
Okay. All right. Have you, now, your book, just so I'm accurate, your book, let me just make sure I got it right here. Beautifully Cruel. That's still on schedule to come out in November?
Yeah, Beautifully Cruel is coming out in December, actually.
Okay.
I have another book called Targeted coming out in October. But Dangerous Ground, My Friendship with a Serial Killer, the serial killer being Happy Face, just came out like 2 weeks ago. So that's the one I'm kind of talking about currently.
Yeah,
but yeah,
let's talk about that. Dangerous Ground. Okay, although it just came out a couple of weeks ago, and it was about 2 weeks. Yeah, and I'm not sure how I found that book or was provided that book, but it's an amazing read, and that kind of was why I asked how you got into it, because there's a section in there where it kind of gives insight into your person or your history, but let's talk about that.
Sure.
Right from the start, the Happy Face Killer. And tell me about the guy, because just go ahead and tell me about the Happy Face Killer, Jesperson.
So Keith Jesperson, I started interviewing him in 2011 as part of my series Dark Minds on Investigation Discovery. So he was like my anonymous serial killer on the show, who Henry Schleff, the president of ID, codenamed, Raven. And Jesperson, up until 2 weeks ago when the book came out, was an anonymous voice on the phone kind of guiding me through unsolved cold cases, serial killer cases. And I would send Jesperson research, and he would comment on the killer that I was kind of looking at, and we'd talk about each case. And through that, I kind of started talking to him about everything. I started talking to him about his life, his crimes, my life, my sister-in-law's murder, my brother's death. We just started to, you know, talk about every single thing, every question everybody would want to ask a serial killer, I began to ask him. This is my seventh book about serial killers, so I had a good, complete background in the psychology of the serial killer. So I thought I could outwit and outsmart him. And that's what I set out to do.
Ultimately,
did
or...
I?
Yeah.
Well, it didn't really turn into that. What it turned into is, you know, in the beginning, a good friend of mine, my partner on Dark Minds, John Kelly, a forensic psychologist who I kind of looked up to as a mentor, as a father figure, really. John warned me. He says, listen, he said, in 2011, when I started talking to Jesperson, it's right in the first couple pages of the book. John says, listen, the devil knocks on your door. You invite him in. You had better be ready to dance with him, because if not, he's going to get inside your head. And I kind of laughed at that, you know. I was like, John, I'm a tough guy, man. Come on. I've been through this. I've been down this road many, many times. I had interviewed serial killers. I had interviewed, you know, 20-something murderers. I mean, been to prisons all over this country, et cetera, crime scenes, et cetera, et cetera. And I should have heeded to that warning, because it happened. You know, he did get inside my head and kind of messed me up completely.
Yeah, you know, and I worry about that. I've done numerous investigations or numerous interviews with all sorts of people at Attica and Rikers in my capacity, right, as an investigator. And the worse they can get in your head, and that's, you just have to really watch it, because man, the tables can turn very quickly. How do you prevent that? I guess what was your tactic at interviewing, if I can just ask that, or expand on that in any way you want to, because I think that's fascinating.
So one of the things that, well, first let me explain that the interviews went from a couple of times a week for Dark Minds to him calling me 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day. Me not picking up that many times, but he was always calling me. So he was calling me. He had written, over the course of the 5 years, he had written 7,000 pages of letters. I have hundreds of hours of audio recordings of our phone calls. And then the prison decided they were going to let us start Skyping. So I have hours of recorded Skype conversations with him. So he's calling me, he's writing me letters, and now he's inside my office on my screen. And it was just like, it was too much. I mean, it just became too much. But to answer your question specifically, I go back to John Kelly. John said, my first name is Matthew. And he said, Matt, listen, when you pick up that phone, no matter what, you're always M. William Phelps. You're always the brand. You're always the reporter. You are never Matthew when you pick up that phone. You got it? And he said, you had better be ready when you pick up that phone, psychologically speaking. And for the most part, I was. So I would prepare myself, or I wouldn't pick up the phone. But a couple times he would catch me off guard, and, you know, he would, you know, a psychopath, when they find an inroad into your, psyche, and they look to charm you. And it's funny, because you sit in the presence of a psychopath for hours at a time, and you don't even realize that they're charming you. You have no idea what they're doing. You know, they're so good at it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah,
we've
exactly
interviewed John Kelly on the show.
Yes, we have.
And it's interesting.
Yeah, John's
to me
a great guy.
How that can happen, but I guess when you get used to somebody to the point where you get comfortable sitting down and having a conversation, whether in person or over the phone, I guess some of your guard kind of automatically goes away if you're not constantly thinking about it.
Yeah. 100%. I mean, you know, as the years moved on, I mean, I had visited him many times up at the prison in Oregon where he is. You know, all these letters, all the phone calls, and look, you know, you begin to feel comfortable. The way that I've been describing it, the metaphor that I've been using is pretty accurate. It's like here in Connecticut, when you go to the ocean, the water's 60 degrees year round, or, you know, during the summer. So when you jump in that cold 60 degree water, it's jarring, it's sobering, it wakes you up. But you stay in that water for a little while, you get used to it, and it gets warmer. Now the temperature of that water has not changed. but you've just gotten used to it. And before you know it, if you're in there long enough, what's going to happen? You're going to get hypothermia. You're going to, you know, you're going to get sick from that water. And that's the kind of thing that happened here. You know, I never realized what was happening as it was happening. It wasn't until later, after I started writing the book and looking at it all and trying to contemplate, Jesus, what happened to me? Why is my life screwed up? Why am I in the hospital? Why am I in the ER with digestive issues? Why do I have all this anxiety? You know, why am I on medication? You know, it's just a slow process.
Mm. Did any of your interactions with him, now you've got some personal tragedies, of course, yourself.
Sure.
Did he exploit any of those or know about any of those?
Well, he would try to, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, he would say to me, he'd say, you know, well, I want to talk about your sister-in-law's murder. And I would say, look, just forget that. That's off limits for you. You know, you do not get to pry into my life. You do not get to know me at all. All right. I am just Phelps to you. I am a reporter. I'm telling your story. I ask the questions. And every once in a while he would hit on it and he'd say, listen, one day he said to me, he said, listen, you know, I said to him, I said, what the hell could you possibly know about my sister-in-law's murder? You know nothing about it. It happened in Hartford, Connecticut in 1996. It's been unsolved for, you know, 20 something years. I mean, she was 5 months pregnant. A pillowcase was put over her head. A telephone cord was wrapped around her neck and she was strangled to death. Mm-hmm. Her and her baby. And, you know, I was like, what the hell could you possibly tell me about that? And he came back with this. He said, listen, he said, week after week, episode after episode, you have sent me research about murders I had no idea about. And it was okay for me to comment on them on your TV show. Why don't you send me research about your sister-in-law's case and let's talk about it? And he did offer some insight into my sister-in-law's murder. It's not the kind of insight that I didn't know or is not obvious, but coming from him, you know, it kind of hit home. I mean, it's like he explained, like, the girls that he killed 8 women.
Okay.
And he said, a lot of those girls, no one cares about. A lot of them, they were missing for weeks at a time, and nobody even said anything. He said, your sister-in-law's case hasn't been solved for 20 years. And he said, I bet they keep telling you every year they're waiting on this, waiting on that. And he's right about that.
Yep.
Just up until last year, you know, I queried a prosecutor that I know in Hartford, and I said, hey, man, what the hell's going on with her case? I mean, you know, you guys been telling us DNA and all this, and he says, oh, we're working on it. We're waiting for DNA. Come on. You're waiting for DNA 22 years later. They're not doing nothing. And there's certain cases in this country, and what I call it is, I call it the Natalie Holloway effect in the book, meaning that if you're blonde, blue-eyed, and you're white, and you're from a wealthy family, or you got money, and you go missing in Aruba, you know, the satellite trucks show up at your doorstep. But damn, if you're a Hispanic, girl, in the inner city and you're a prostitute, there's no satellite truck showing up at your house. You know what I'm saying? And you go missing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a double standard in this country. And not to take away anything from Natalie Holloway. That's not what I mean by that. What I mean by that is, you know, he hit it on the head. My sister-in-law wasn't the most liked person, you know, if you know what I mean. She was not doing all the right things in life that she should have been doing, but it doesn't mean her life is not as important as any other life.
Amen.
You know?
Amen. Yeah. She was a daughter, right?
That's right.
And a
That's
mother
right.
to be and a wife. So, maybe this is part of the reason why. I mean, I lived through the brutal frenzied murder of my uncle, killed in the home where I grew up, in fact, in the
wow.
bedroom.
Okay. Sorry. I'm sorry
no,
to
no,
hear that.
You know
that's,
what?
That's
I mean,
horrible.
Thank you. And that crime went unsolved for 5 years. And I took that case on with my partner back in 1987. And out of 5 years, we were able to bring information that brought the killer to justice. He's now serving life in
wow.
prison.
Wow.
Okay. But that took a big that took a toll on me, and it took something out of me that I don't think I'll ever
absolutely.
Get back.
Absolutely.
But so I understand what you're saying, and I think that, so there's that kinship there in reading, of course, about you and reading Dangerous Minds or Dangerous Ground, in reading that, I understand. I really do. And I think Dangerous Ground is so informative, in many respects.
You make an excellent, excellent point. And here's the point. Every time I kind of stepped foot in that territory of my sister-in-law's murder to use my investigative skills and my contacts, something's telling me, this one's too close, you know, step aside from that. And it's weird because I can investigate murders all year long, which I do, you know, cold cases, all of that. But, you know, a personal stake in it is, wow, changes the game completely, completely. So I definitely understand what you're saying, you know, yeah. Cause there's personal emotion involved, and not that I, you know, me and her, we weren't on good terms or nothing when she was murdered. My brother, her husband was living with me at the time, and they were estranged, and, you know, there was tension, but nonetheless, I mean, their kids, my niece and nephews are, you know, our blood.
Yes.
You know? So it's tough, man. It is tough.
And the road that you travel today and have traveled to write your books, is a road that not too many people, very few actually, I would suspect, will ever travel. Do you consider Dangerous Ground, that book, to be your magnum opus, if you will, to date about serial killers in general?
It's the pinnacle book of my career. I'll never write another book like Dangerous Ground. I mean, and there'll never be a bigger toll taken on my life than I lost my faith through the process of writing that book. And I was a devout Catholic going to mass 4 or 5 times a week. Mm. And, 10 years of that. And I stopped. That's a very touchy thing for me right now. And I lost a lot of other things. And one of the questions I was asked early on in this by a good friend, Dr. Catherine Ramsland, who you probably know and probably had on your show. She's written 40, 50 books. She's a forensic psychologist. She was reading the manuscript, and she's like, well, you know, why did you stay in this? I'm curious why you stayed in this so long if it was affecting you so badly. And that's really an unfair question, in a sense that I didn't know I was in it that deep. You know what I'm saying? I'm in it, and what's keeping me going through this is the Jane Doe portion of this. There's the last third of the book. There's two stories about two Jane Does that I investigate and try to solve. And that's what kept me going. The idea that I could maybe bring a Jane Doe home to her family. Because right now, Jane Doe Florida, as I call her, she is a box of bones in a forensic lab in Florida.
Oh.
And her spirit is just roaming the earth, waiting to land where it belongs. In that gravesite in the town where she lives, but we don't know who she is. So, and Jesperson was very open and honest about how he killed her, where he dumped her, what she said, her, you know, the name she gave him, what she was wearing, all of this stuff. And we just haven't been able to identify her yet. And so that keeps me going, you know, and that's part of the redeeming aspect of this for me.
That to me would that's a good reason to keep going, and certainly
that's right,
that's admirable. I mean, it'd be because you take that human. See, I think a lot of times too, and I'll get your opinion on this. You watch shows like what's the show with the Criminal Minds, right? You watch shows like Criminal Minds, go ahead.
No, I don't.
Okay.
But no, go ahead. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Well, you know, the shows, they don't provide that. I mean, obviously the graphics are there. You know, the latest graphics are there. They show the brutality of the crime, but they don't oftentimes really get into the real, toll it takes, or they try to, but in my opinion, they miss the mark all the time. You know,
it's funny. You're absolutely right. I mean, I can't watch those shows. I can't watch them for a number of reasons. One reason is I do it all day long, 12 hours a day, whatever, and to watch it at night just seems redundant and it seems ridiculous to me. But, you know, when you talk about a drama like Criminal Minds, right? They get the crime scene right, as you said, but they don't get the emotion right. You know, they don't get the toll that it takes on these cops. I mean, I eat lunch, I eat dinner with cops all over this country, and, you know, sometimes if I'm with a producer or something who hasn't been in the game for a long time, I have to tell him or her, I have to say, listen, you know, we're going tonight to dinner with some detectives. And these guys have been on the job 30 years. They're going to joke and talk about things that you're going to find offensive and that you're going to think, wow, but that's how they deal with this, okay? These guys have seen the worst of the worst, and that's how they deal with this stuff. So don't take it personally. And that reality is missing from those shows. I would even say that reality is missing from a lot of the true crime shows we see on TV today.
Absolutely. And that's a good point, because you're in that true crime industry. You've been there. And if anyone would know, you would know, and I believe that to be the case. That's missing from, and that's a critical component to what we experience as family members of victims, or even as investigative journalists like yourself, investigators like yourself.
That's right.
I get that. So, okay, but back to Dangerous Ground. Just walk us through any part of the book, because we've got about 20 minutes here of our interview left. Just walk us through whatever part of that book you'd like us to know, the audience to know, because I would really love our audience members who are interested in true crime to really pick up this book, buy this book, and read it, because to me, this is informative, educational, and in some parts inspirational, in a kind of a sideways way, but nonetheless. You do such a great job, especially the personalizing, putting your fingerprint on your. I don't want to give too much away, but just how you have done things or how you've explained things really put your personal touch on things. But just walk us through Dangerous Mind and or Dangerous Ground. I keep saying that. what the heck is
saying before the interview?
Dangerous Ground. I apologize. Dangerous Ground. Folks, Dangerous Ground. If I say the other one more time, I'll put a dollar in the jar. But walk us through, if you don't mind, any part of the book that you think is
sure
stellar.
I think one of the parts of the book that particularly tells the story of how much this material affected me is the story of one of his victims. Now, just to digress a minute and back up, I've written 34 books, four historical true crime, and the rest are all, you know, straightforward, basically true crime. Most of those books, save for this one, most of those books are about cases that were fully adjudicated when I came to them. Meaning, I came in, and I looked at all the material, I interviewed people, I sat down, I wrote the book. And for the most part, those books, when I wrote them, I go into my office at 5 a.m., I emerge at 5 p.m., and I close the door and I go about my life. All right? I can shut it down. Okay? With Dangerous Ground, there was no way of shutting this off. And here's an example, going back to that victim. There was one victim of his who he tied underneath his truck and dragged for 12 miles. And he gave me every aspect of this murder imaginable. The before, the during, the after, everything he was feeling, everything he was thinking, what the victim went through. That was bad enough. So as we're going through this all, I said, Jesperson, I said, listen, I got to ask you this question. No one's asked you this question. I got to ask you this question. I said, was she alive or was she dead when you tied her underneath your truck? Because everybody's assuming she was alive, she was dead, and you know, he just was getting rid of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, he says, what kind of person do you think I am? And I mm-hmm. said, what kind of person do I think you are? I said, you're an effing serial killer, man. You're a psychopath. That's who you are. That's a fair question. Now answer it. And he says to me, he starts laughing, and he has this, in a lot of the Skype interviews, he has this way of his shoulders bouncing up and down when he laughs, and he's laughing. And he says, well, it would be a much better story if she was alive, wouldn't it, Phelps? But he says, I think she was dead. And that right there to me just personified how he re-victimizes his victims, how he minimizes his victims, how he always would refer to his victims as it or they or her, never by a name.
Mm.
And that story, that image is something that I would wake up in bed in the middle of the night and stare at the ceiling and see images of this woman being tied underneath the truck. I mean, so that's how affecting certain parts of this were for me. And you know, I'd get up in the morning and just go right back at it. You know what I'm saying? And,
sure.
And
wow.
Go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
I'm just amazed, you know, for him to even ask that question, what kind of person do you think I am?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the mind of a psychopath.
Exactly.
He believed at that point that what he was saying was, Phelps, you know me so well by now. What kind of person do you think I am? And you know, the thing about a psychopath is that, you know, as I was saying this earlier, before you know it, they're charming you and you don't even realize it. You know, they're so good at it. One case of his that he's tied to is a girl named Cynthia Rose. And if you Google his name and Cynthia Rose, you know, he's tied to that name. That's like his last victim, victim eight, I believe, it's one of his eight. Now, when we started talking, he started to tell me, he said, I didn't kill Cynthia Rose. And I would roll my eyes and I'd say, here's a serial killer telling me he didn't kill one of his victims. And it's like, okay, here we go. Here's the song and dance. And he's like, no, Phelps, I did not kill her. I didn't say I didn't kill a woman and dump her where they found Cynthia Rose, but I did not kill Cynthia Rose. And I tell that story in the final third of the book about how I started off, of course, not believing him. But after 3 years investigation, I proved that he was right, that he did not kill Cynthia Rose. And that means if he didn't kill Cynthia Rose, what does that mean? It means that the woman he did kill is still buried where he put her. That's what that means.
Interesting. Wow.
Which is 150 feet away from where Cynthia Rose was found. That's the most interesting part of it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So you have this girl, Cynthia Rose, who was found next to this tree, near Turlock, California, in back of the Blueberry Hill Cafe. And you have this serial killer come forward. She's found in like 1994, I believe. And you have the serial killer come forward a year later when he's caught. He starts giving up bodies and he describes how he picked up a girl at a rest stop in Turlock. He drove 12 miles. He dumped her in back of the Blueberry Hill Cafe on this day. So they go back and they look and they say, oh, Cynthia Rose, she was found that day in back of the Blueberry Hill Cafe, right next to where he says he found her, next to a tree. Bang. They just write it off. They put her name on his list of victims and bang. Mm-hmm. And what happens is in 2009, he's answering some charges in California, he tells me, and he sees a picture on a file of Cynthia Rose. And he says to the prosecutor and detective, who's that girl? And they're like, that's Cynthia Rose. You murdered her. He's like, I didn't murder that girl. It was the first time he ever saw a picture of her. And according to him, they said, get that file away from him. That case is already end, shut, closed, get it away from him. So there's one thing about Jesperson that is a recurring theme in this book. And that is whenever there's a wrong against him and he knows he's right, he needs to shout from the top of the mountaintops, who got it wrong, and he needs to correct that. So that's his game.
There's a level of braggadociousness.
Hubris, there. Yep.
Yeah, hubris, yep. Right.
Absolutely. Hubris, narcissism, you know, ego. It's all about, I'm right, you're wrong. Ha, ha, ha. You know, that's his game.
Well, no, according to his first victim was Tonya Bennett, right in January 1990.
Yep.
What sparked that? I mean, you go back to the first murder in a serial killer spree of murders, and do you look at that one more than the others, and what sparked that murder, according to Jesperson?
Right. I spend the first kind of 100 pages on that case because it's the pivotal case. It's the case that started the others, and not only that, but two people were arrested, tried, and convicted and put in prison for 4 years for that first murder he committed, while he went on to commit seven more murders.
Mm.
So that makes it an even more interesting case. But so what sparked that? What made the serial killer in him emerge in that case? Well, there were a lot of factors working all at once when he met Tonya Bennett. And it all comes back to women and his anger and rage issues with the females, especially who he believes is using him in some way or is not fulfilling promises that he believes he is entitled to. And for me, it goes back to, the divorce, his divorce from Rose kind of hurt him, and then it's like he moves in with this other woman, Roberta Ellis, and she takes off on him with a trucker, and it's like all his life, women kind of would disparage him and would maybe make fun of him. I heard from several people that women would, some women would say, you're small, he's a 6'7", 300-pound man, but he's very small. In other ways, and that would really get him excited. But you know what it is? It's really comes down to if he thought a female was using him to get something, that's it. That flipped that switch, and that volcanic rage, it just poured out of him. And Tonya Bennett certainly did that to him. That night, but no fault of her own. I mean, she was just telling him no. You know what I mean? And he didn't want to hear no. He thought he deserved a yes. And she ended up, paying the price for that.
That kind of, at least in my view, that kind of hooked me, on the book itself, on the book, Dangerous Ground, the explanation and how you, well, the information about that. Now, let me ask this. Did you have any contact with his daughter, Melissa Moore? And if so, what kind of contact?
It's funny you should mention that. It's really funny you should mention that because I got such a sour taste in my mouth about her right now as we speak I just better not say any more than that. I mean, she's on Dr. Oz now, to keep it short. She's on Dr. Oz. I spent the last 3 weeks, producing and developing a segment, about my book for Dr. Oz. Oh. And then she put her foot forward and said, no, that's not going to happen. And they just canceled my segment the other day. And it's like, look, Melissa Moore is a victim. I mean, she's the daughter of a monster.
Right.
And I get that. And she's a victim. And again, we come back to Keith Jesperson wanting to right what he believes is a wrong. And what he believes is, and I'm not saying I believe it, I'm saying what he believes. He believes that the story of him strangling those kittens that she put out there in her book, he's telling me that's false, man. I never did any of that. I wasn't that person then. And he tells a different story. So she tells one story in her book. He tells another story here in my book. It's her word against his, I guess you could say, but, it's like, yeah, I mean, she's a victim, she's a victim. I'm a victim. I'm one of his victims too. I mean,
exactly.
Not to take away from, his murder victims, but yeah, you know.
Go ahead.
Melissa's a victim.
Well,
Melissa's definitely a victim.
The way she portrayed herself when interviewed, I think it was Daily Mail back a couple of years ago. I just have a problem with that. I have to side with you on this because it's interesting, especially if a serial killer denied. And you would know if anyone. I think you would know, and an argument could be made. Well, the daughter would know too, but he's got every reason to be more open with you, I think, you know, about the events early on and about torturing of animals. I just, you know, it just seems a little bit too neat and tidy to me.
I'm with you. And here's the thing: she's 5 years old when supposedly this happens. She tells this story; it's full of detail. And he said to me, and he's quoted in the book, he said, it's very simple. He said that how she describes in all that detail and where this all happened. We didn't live there till 5 years after this supposedly happened. And he said, you just go back and look at the school records and you can see we weren't even living there at the time. So, you know, something simple like that, you know, I get it, but you know, yeah, it's sour taste, man.
I hear you.
When someone's editorializing something like that, that's not journalism to me. When someone is saying, you know, well, no, I don't want to do that because of this. You know, it's like I said, it's sour taste, and
no,
I haven't said the last word about it yet. I will.
Yeah, I'm going to be following you very closely, not stalking you, just following you, just to hear that last word. Dangerous Ground author M. William Phelps, mwilliamphelps.com. All of his books available on Amazon. 4 historical true crime books and 34 in total. But Dangerous Ground, I think, to me. And now I have to admit I have not read all 34 of your books. In fact, Dangerous Ground is the only one I've really read. My producer had Nathan Hale, I think it was something about Nathan.
Yeah.
Hale. But nonetheless, I think that this is just an absolute work of art when it comes to really kind of laying out the mind, the methods of the serial killer, and the interpersonal relationship that you had with the Happy Face killer. Do you still keep, I mean, is there still communication or no?
Yeah, he called me 6 times today. You know, I didn't answer, but he called 6 times today. He calls all week, and I communicate with him about once every 2 weeks now, just because I'm doing media for the book, and you know, but the sooner or later I'm just going to cut the cord. I mean, I just can't keep doing this. I can't keep seeing that number come up on my phone. Just seeing that Tellmate number come up, it's like,
man,
it's like a stab in the stomach, you know. It's like, you know, yeah. I mean, and I still receive at least 30 to 40 pages of letters from him every week. I have probably 50, 60 letters that I haven't opened, still on my desk. Not to mention at least 100 letters from the 700 letters or so I got that I haven't opened.
I just can't
keep up with it. I just can't keep up with it.
And
the art, he sends me art. I mean, it's, you know, it's just, it's endless, you know.
That's incredible. And I just want to remind people, I mean, you were actually physically, it took a physical toll on you. This did.
Yeah. I mean, there were days when I was on the floor of my bathroom by myself. No one was around in the corner, just with intestinal issues from anxiety. And just in pain and crying, and I would call my doctor and he'd be like, Matt, listen, dude, you're under so much stress. You gotta let this go. And then it would get better, and I wouldn't talk to him for a couple of days, and I'd just continue, and then I'd be back out, and I'd be in the ER with, you know, getting CAT scans, and you know.
Sure.
It really manifested, and someone put it very plainly to me a while back. They're like, you know, you were possessed by the devil, man. you were possessed by the devil. I mean, and you know, as a metaphor, that's a good metaphor. I was possessed. That's absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Well, you know, our audience is predominantly Christian. We are a Christian-based radio show. And I've got to say that, you know, faith, brother, faith. I know it's tough. I know it's tough, but, you know, yeah, that's all I'll say. But, anyway.
It's tough in today's world, you know.
Yes, it is.
I write in dangerous ground about my faith when it starts slipping that, you know, when you work in television and nothing against atheists or any of those people don't believe. I have nothing against them. But when you work in television publishing, you meet a lot of atheists. They're just there for some reason. I don't know why. And so I would travel with atheists, you know, and they wouldn't be preaching to me or nothing like that. It just, you know, and I'm like, at one point, I write in the book, I get to the cliff and I'm looking down and, you know, there's Christopher Hitchens on one side and Richard Dawkins on the other, and they're waiting to catch me. You know what I mean? As I jump off the cliff, you know, and that's how it felt. That's how it felt because I was such a devout Catholic going to mass, all, you know, trying to keep the light shining into my life, and it just stopped working for me.
Wow.
You know?
Well, we've got about 2 minutes left, of the program. I just wanted to say thank you. I do hope that when people hear this interview, it gives people a little bit more insight into the man behind Dangerous Ground, the book that I think is perhaps one of the most, compelling, books in terms of the mind of a serial killer and the interpersonal relationship between the author and the serial killer. It's in terms of serial killers and true crime and books and authors and such, this is perhaps one of the best and most comprehensive book. The book is Dangerous Ground. You got about a minute. Last word. It's to you, sir.
Well, thank you so much for all those. That praise is very humbling and it's an honor. I mean, I just, you know, I sat down and I never expected to write this book, planned on writing this book. It wrote itself and I sat down and just kind of, you know, started writing. A lot of the personal memories in this book I wrote when they came. I didn't sit down and try to dredge them up. I just wrote them wherever I was, volleyball, church, park, wherever, whenever they came up. And, yeah, it's been a pleasure talking about it. I really thank you for the in-depth interview.
Well, I know your time is extremely valuable. You've got so many venues that you're, you know, so many interviews that you do, and thank you for your gift of time. As we vie for your attention, along with people like Fox and Friends and other media outlets. So carry on, keep going, and then we're gonna be promoting your book, Dangerous Ground. We wish you a lot of success. We really do.
Thank you so much, and stay in touch.
Yeah, I hope to hear from you soon. I'll have you back on, and we'll talk more in depth about different your book, this book, and other books, perhaps. All right.
Yeah, great.
All right, brother.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Folks, that was M. William Phelps.
MWilliamPhelps.com is the website.
Absolutely compelling book, Dangerous Ground. Yeah, I left it in my office. If I known, I would show it to you, but I can't, so... don't forget, tomorrow, or this weekend, I'm gonna be doing a special on the Awan brothers, and then also, just watch Twitter and feed and Facebook, and, you keep up that way. But Joe, thanks for taking the first part of the program. Appreciate that. And, for all your help, and Eric the Tech as well.
That'll do it for us. Until Monday, have a great weekend.